Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Anthropology, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Reagan Gillum, a host on the channel, and today I'm talking to Dr. Natalie Valdez, who is the author of the book Weighing the Future, Race, Science, and Pregnancy Trials in the Post-Genomic Era, published by the University of California Press. Dr. Valdez, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
You know, thanks so much for coming today. And so in the book, you examine these research trials or studies that intervene in the behavioral choices of pregnant people, such as trying to change their diet and exercise. So I wanted to just start with a question we normally begin with, which is, how did you come to write this book and what got you interested in this topic?
Yes, I've gotten this question quite a few times because people are pretty surprised to hear about these trials. They were like, I had a similar reaction when I first learned about pregnancy trials. I had no idea that there were large, extensive international pregnancy trials occurring, because I had the understanding that, you know, since 1950s or that after the thalidomide trials, pregnant people were vulnerable populations, and so they were not recruited into clinical trials for drug interventions or drug experimentation. So they are vulnerable populations protected from pharmaceutical development trials, but that's changing. It just changed this last few years that pregnant people are now going to be recruited into clinical trials for drug developments. But these trials are, as you said, behavioral, and they are deemed quote unquote safe for pregnant participants. And the way that I've gotten into studying pregnancy trials is, of course, retrospectively sounds linear, but in the moment was a kind of amaze that I was just trusting my intuition to be curious about maternal health interventions and nutritional interventions in general. So my background is that in my undergrad research, I participated in nutritional interventions in the Department of Psychology, and I was doing research in medical anthropology. So I have a long background working in nutritional interventions, and I was really interested in public health. And my in my grad application, I had pitched a project on metabolic illness around the U.S.-Mexico border. So I was thinking about those ideas. I was thinking about nutrition and food. And I had explored a lot of different iterations of this project in my first three summers of grad school. And I wasn't able to land on something concretely until I applied for the School of Public Health program at UC Berkeley. And when I was accepted, I also received an NSF grant, and I had to pick one or the other. So I was able to do an intercampus exchange program at UC Berkeley, and I studied in the School of Public Health there. And in the coursework and the research mentors that I had, I was able to be, I learned of these clinical trials. So that's the initial encounter, was through my coursework and research at the School of Public Health in Berkeley. And then I started to request permission to work on an ongoing trial that I had learned about in the United States. And so that took on around 2 years of gaining access and permission. And once I gained permission at that first trial site, I was more legible at other trial sites as that kind of snowball sampling, but also networking kind of goes, is that once you've been recognized as working in a particular space, other people feel like you've been vouched for in that kind of way. So I entered the US trial and it worked out for both of us in that the PI really needed educated, experienced researchers who had done nutritional interventions and were bilingual. And so I fit that need for them. And I, in exchange, asked for access to interview the staff, observe all the processes of implementation. And we had to work out an agreement on what kind of data I could use, which is a longer response, but I'm happy to follow up on that. But yeah, so my initial encounter was through the School of Public Health, and that really helped shape a lot of the research questions that came out of the coursework and connecting with researchers who were designing and implementing and asking questions about maternal health policies and interventions. And then, of course, I started to see this convergence around maternal health interventions within the realm of metabolic illnesses like diabetes and obesity and epigenetics and DOHAD or developmental origins of health and disease. So there's a convergence that occurs in these spaces that I bear witness to as clinical trials are drawing from epigenetics and DOHAD to justify the value of intervening during pregnancy because it is framed as a critical period of development. And so, of course, these interventions and diet of a diet and exercise had a longer history, and I go into that in my chapter two. But there's a particular moment in the 2010s, 2013-14 that that clinical trials started to draw on this literature in DOHAD and epigenetics to further justify these kinds of interventions. So that's a roundabout way, but hopefully it makes sense that I've explored a lot of interdisciplinary areas across medical anthropology, STS, and public health. And those exploratory kind of experiences led me to encounter pregnancy trials.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that definitely makes a lot of sense. And I think it's so important to hear how people came to these topics, because one might think it's just one linear drive to one topic. And as you say, it's, you know, there's a process and a series of discoveries for the self that leads you to a particular area. And so I guess building off of that, I wondered if you could tell us about the setting for the research to these pregnancy trials. As you said that you didn't know about the trials, I also had no idea that such trials existed. However, I probably shouldn't have been surprised, because I myself have taken part in other human research trials, you know, in the past. But the trials in your book are recruiting pregnant people for scientific research. So I just wondered if you could tell us, you know, what are the researchers hoping to find out? What are pregnant people expected to do generally to participate in the research? And what countries did you focus on? So if you could just generally orient us to the research setting.
Yeah, absolutely. So pregnancy trials are not, they don't look exactly the same everywhere, but they are designed in very similar ways. So that's to say the infrastructural support for where a trial is implemented can vary depending on whether or not that trial site is associated with a teaching hospital in a large urban area or a smaller clinic in a rural area. And so the settings can look differently based on those kinds of factors. I focused on clinical trials that were on particular sites in the United States and the United Kingdom. The clinical trial in the United States had several sites across the country. I only focused on one main site. And these clinical trials are often part of larger consortium trials, which with a consortium is a collection of trials. So the NIH and NIDTK, various national health institutes for health research were funding these clinical trials across the country. The site that I was working on in the US was not associated with a public teaching hospital, which meant that we as staff members had to visit clinics, private and public clinics, and recruit from their waiting rooms, basically. So we would go into a prenatal clinic, a maternal health clinic, and wait in the waiting room and try and catch people in their first prenatal visit, at least between 7 to 12 weeks gestation. They really needed to be recruited and randomized into the clinical trial by 14 weeks gestation, no later than 16 weeks gestation, because the variability increases in a lot of different areas after that. So we had a crucial period of time to recruit. Recruitment looks really differently in different locations. So if you are in a clinic in a more rural area, you're not going to have access to the large databases in clinical or in hospitals. So the numbers are harder to reach. It's very arduous and exhausting, hours and hours waiting to collect, to be able to even encounter pregnant people in the clinics. So that's what it kind of looks like for recruitment in a smaller versus a large teaching hospital. I then also had the experience of working or observing in a larger teaching hospital in the UK that this hospital was handling over 1,200 births a year. And so because this was also a teaching hospital within the National Health System or the NHS in the UK. And so these settings create a standardized kind of universalized system such that every researcher associated with the trial had access to a database that had all the information for anyone who came in through the hospital. And so that was a huge resource for recruitment. And you basically looked at this computer, this database, you knew when somebody was going to have an appointment for their first prenatal appointment, you knew their BMI, which was a body mass index, which was really important for eligibility for these clinical trials. And you'd go from, you know, one floor down to another floor to recruit. And so that was a very immediate kind of, everything was centralized at that teaching hospital. So the labor and the time and the effort looks really differently if you're trying to recruit from multiple clinics versus a large teaching hospital. And of course, these are trials that are funded by national agencies. And so they're carried out in a very large international context too. So the clinical trials that I worked on were also in conversation with each other because they're doing these large, similarly designed clinical trials on pregnant populations using interventions of diet and exercise. Can you remind me of the rest of the question? Does that give you a little bit of an idea of what it looks like, the setting for clinical trials?
Oh, definitely. And the other question was, what are the pregnant people expected to do to participate?
Oh, right. So in order to be eligible for these clinical trials, you have to have a viable pregnancy. You have to be within a certain gestational age. You have to have a BMI. In the United States, the BMI cutoff was 25. And in the UK, the BMI cutoff was 30. And I can get into those numbers if you're interested in, but those are kind of standard classifications for overweight populations and obese populations. So 25 and over is technically classified as overweight, and 30 and over with a BMI of 30 and over is classified as obese. And that BMI classification is assessed at the intake appointment. And so pregnant people earlier in their gestation, the BMI is supposed to be indicative of that kind of pre-pregnancy BMI and not necessarily including all of the variability in weight once conception and development advances. So there were a lot of metrics, a lot of calculations that we had to make in order to make sure that based on gestational time and weight, there was this eligibility met around BMI. The other eligibility requirement was that the pregnant people had to not have any other comorbidities. So they could not have, they couldn't be diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, for instance. And the other main requirement was that they would be ethnically, racially diverse. And those definitions really changed or were really different in different places. But the site that I was looking at in the U.S. really focused on comparing Hispanic and non, quote unquote, Hispanic and non-Hispanic populations. And that's the language they were using in the trial. And the pregnant participants were in intake. So we, you know, recruit them. And once they're recruited, we give them their consent form. We randomize them at the first session, which means that they are randomly assigned to a control or experimental group of the trial. And they are required to do assessments, which is a various kinds of data collection, biobehavioral data collection. So a lot of surveys, assessing behaviors, and then blood, urine, some, and then the biosamples could differ depending on whether or not participants consented to different kinds of biosamples. So the UK would collect similar kinds of biosamples. The U.S. trial site varied a little bit as well, but for the most part, everyone collected blood at various times of gestation, urine, cord blood, and sometimes placenta. And but you could also collect breast milk, fecal samples, even hair samples. It varies significantly, but there's a lot of biobehavioral pregnant data that's collected and you consent to at these various stages, regardless of being in the intervention or control group. So the control group was standard prenatal care, and you basically came in for your data collection assessments. The intervention or experimental group for the US meant that they met with a nutritional interventionist or a staff member like myself who would deliver this intervention to them every 2 weeks for about 6 months of their pregnancy. This intervention maintained a kind of you needing to count their calories, count their steps, keep a food journal, weigh themselves every day, and replace breakfast and lunch with a liquid beverage. That was the kind of intervention in the US site. In the UK, the intervention was mostly counting steps, assessing physical activity, and changing from a high glycemic diet to a low glycemic diet. So that meant counting the amount of fat and sugar content. So high glycemic diet is very particular to carbs, sugar assessments. So it's a epistemologically different understanding of metabolism and nutrition, counting calories versus counting grams of sugar and fat. But the ultimate goal was to reduce the amount of weight gained in the U.S. trial. And in the U.K., it was mainly trying to reduce rates of gestational diabetes, which is a form of diabetes that you can contract during gestation, which leaves or disappears after you deliver a child or after birth. And can return decades later. So gestational diabetes is a very mysterious illness, a metabolic illness. But yes, generally the main health outcomes for both of the trials were to quote unquote improve healthy pregnancies by reducing weight gain, reducing risk of gestational diabetes, and improving health outcomes for the infants, which also were assessed by how neonatal infant adiposity. So whether these were quote unquote fat babies or babies that were assumed to be within a healthy amount of weight. And then their glycemic levels taken at infancy. So there were a few different assessments or health outcomes that both trials were all interested in achieving through the intervention. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for that introduction to the site. So as you were participating as a researcher in these trials, one of the arguments that you make in the book, and that really, you know, held the book together, it was continued throughout the book, was that these trials focus on the individual pregnant person as a site of intervention and not the social conditions in which they would find themselves, which can also be damaging for pregnancy, such as the environmental conditions of pollution or social conditions of racism or poverty. These wider conditions were not accounted for in these trials that you were involved in. And so I wondered if you could tell us what you would want to about this argument. And I also wondered how you came to this particular argument.
Right. So that's absolutely one of the kind of findings in terms of thinking about what is the focus in these trials. And so thinking about the individual in relation to the structural or the population is a long-standing point of inquiry for sociology, anthropology, epidemiologists. And so it's not necessarily a new finding nor a new argument, but I make the case that these particular kinds of scientific theories and methodologies and technologies are exacerbating the individualistic focus in particularly new ways in a 21st century post-genomic context. So as social scientists, we've consistently come to this conundrum around how does the individual relate to the larger population and how is that relationship studied? And so I think my work contributes to that kind of curiosity by bringing in unique ethnographic insights from ongoing clinical trials that simultaneously draw on large population ideas about public population health and public health interventions, but then narrow it down to the individual. So there's a very unique process in the clinical translation of these ideas at practice in the sites that I'm looking at. So the reason that I came up to this argument really is drawing on a lot of the literature that has already come up in medical anthropology, social epidemiology around how do we think about population health and this question that's been becoming more significant in the last few decades around precision medicine and predictive medicine that's really taking on an individual attention to customizing your health based on your own particular kind of genomic sequence. And so there is this interesting resurgence around the precision predictive that centers on this very particular kind of genomic expression at the individual scale. And then, of course, needing to create population level interventions. So the pregnancy trials and pregnancy trials within a post-genomic era offer up a great site for thinking about these longstanding questions. And the main thing that I want to assert is that it's of course, there is an issue with only focusing on individuals. But the main thing is that this kind of focus is political. So redistributing a ton of national and international resources into clinical trials that are extremely expensive to run in order to test interventions that will show whether or not individual behavior change can effectively address chronic illness it's a broken record. Like we could cure diabetes and obesity if only you'd stop eating that donut or if only you went out for a walk a little bit more. So this is also within the field of metabolic illness, a very common trope. But when we look again at this kind of like, how do we create population level interventions that work for everybody, but then also cater it to an individual, and then how do we reinvest our health resources into these spaces? I try to emphasize the very particular kinds of power relations and politics, especially around race and racism, that emerge at these levels. So my main comment is that individual interventions need to be read as symptomatic of systemic racism and not actually a solution to broader metabolic illnesses that plague predominantly poor people of color. So this is becomes really important to emphasize. So it's not just that like we need to focus on the structural, which is a point that I'm making, but the reason that I'm making that point is that these individual interventions are assuming that poor brown and black bodies are in fact riskier and they need to be targeted for interventions. And so I'm also bringing in this very clear connection between individual interventions, individualism, the ideologies that underground individual interventions at the expense of structural interventions that are absolutely tied to race and racism. So whose bodies? It's particular individual bodies that are targeted. And so that becomes part of the larger argument to say, yes, it's echoing much of the research that says structural interventions are necessary over individual ones. And I'll keep, you know, sounding the horn on that same note over and over again. And specifically that the continuous investment on individuals is part of a racial politics in thinking about our health, which is that certain bodies are targeted and certain bodies are deemed at risk. And that comes through in these ideas of individual responsibility. And that's something that I really think is important in reminding us. It's not just about neoliberal policies that make individuals more responsible, but the specific stakes of that. And it becomes even more consequential when we're thinking about pregnancy because of the amounts, the degradation of maternal rights and the ways in which state surveillance can come in and make more and more decisions around individual bodies and behaviors and choices around that. So for instance, thinking with Kara Bridges' work on reproducing race, if certain pregnant people, or particularly African-American pregnant people who went in and were receiving Medicaid and they didn't follow their nutritional guidelines, it could be held accountable legally and criminally. And so that is a very different, manifestation of individual control, surveillance, and management that is absolutely based on racism and not necessarily just this kind of relationship between the individual and the structural. So emphasizing that is part of the agenda here alongside many Black feminist scholarship that have been writing on reproduction and racism in these same spaces as well. So I'm hoping that we unfortunately haven't come that far from the decades of scientific kind of evolutions, revolutions, paradigmatic shifts that we have to say the same things over and over again. But I am hopeful that this particular kind of site will land on people in a way that makes it urgent to rethink the way in which we invest in population health and maternal health in particular.
Yeah, that's so important what you just said. And I'm going to follow up then with what you were talking about race and racism, power and racial politics, because of course in the book as well, you state that race doesn't cause disease, racism does. And I thought this was so important in thinking about just health and medicine in general. We've seen with COVID-19, the pandemic, how African-American and Latinx populations have died at, you know, greater rates. And so I thought these findings around race are, you know, they have continued salience in so many different aspects. And for you, you're looking again in these pregnancy trials, and they seem to be carried out in ways, you know, that did not align with this emphasis on racism rather than race. And so how did the trials treat race during recruitment and the carrying out of research? And how does racism make people sick?
Oh, great questions. So the trials treat categories of race as classificatory forms of organizing populations. And that is very common in the ways in which racial classifications and racial categories have been used in public health since the 1993 NIH mandate to recruit, quote, women and minorities into clinical trials. And so, of course, we have the work of Stephen Epstein and the Politics of Inclusion that lays out this kind of the aftermath of that initial policy. And, you know, now I'm here thinking we're 30 years after this initial policy intervention made at national levels, and the UK is following this as well, which is why they recruit ethnically diverse people, uniquely defined. But in the US, it was categories of, you know, African American, white, Native American, quote unquote Hispanic. Those were the main categories that they were trying to recruit. And different sites across the United States were set up in order to recruit particular populations because those sites had a demographic that could meet those requirements, the recruitment, the target population for recruitment. So that's why they spread out across the country in order to meet those numbers. But it is extremely difficult to recruit ethnically diverse pregnant populations in general, because it's hard to, there are a lot of different reasons for that, and I can kind of get into with it. But the question about race is that they are using these race as a classification category only. And we know that these categories are unstable. They are often inaccurate in representing individual experiences or understandings of personal identity. And they're not rigorously used or in a standard way. So Hunt and McGessie's work have shown that in a lot of the use of racial categories in genomic research is different for every different research project. And that's the same for clinical trials. I've also found that different clinical trials will use different sets of classification systems. And that's, you know, coming out of one of my articles in medical anthropology called The Improvisation of Race in Clinical Trials, which is, you know, when you're recruiting somebody and you ask them, what do you identify? You have five, and you give them five categories, and people are like, well, you know, for instance, this would be the case for some folks in the US where they identify as Afro-Latinos and that category really presented a challenge because the groups were either Hispanic or non-white Hispanic or non-Hispanic white. And so it was just a very complicated ambiguous zone. And so when we are thinking about these complexities at an individual level, how do people identify? And then how does that match up to categories that are imposed from the design table or at a population level? There's a lot that gets improvised and kind of, very much somewhat made up in the process of filling out those surveys. And in the UK, it was similar because they actually had a classification 1 through 10, which like was a much more complicated classification system, but then they used another one on top of that was only 4 categories. So this is all to say that the classifications of race are a limited measure of organizing populations, which is why I really tried to make the emphasis in the text that comparing groups across race does not address the underlying force that shapes differences in health outcomes. And that force is racism. And so if we're trying to address disparities in health across race, but we refuse to study racism, we will continuously reproduce studies that find disparities in health, but do not address or intervene on those disparities. And so the use of race in these clinical trials is similar to in other research, which is that it's descriptive and mostly inaccurate in assessing experiences on the ground level. And they often are used to compare health outcomes as opposed to address the differences and the gaps that are motivated by systemic racism. So that's a big issue. The question of like, we need more diversity in clinical research is no doubt a worthy cause. However, the way in which we've been doing it since the 90s has not been effective in ameliorating racist disparities in health. And so the book is really trying to make a case for thinking about racism as a health variable that should be studied and taken seriously. Well and beyond just the recruitment of ethnically diverse categories of groups of people.
Yeah, thank you. And so I wondered if you could talk about some of the methods you used to carry out the study. You talked about this a little bit in the beginning, and I thought that as a researcher wanting to do research about research, I thought that possibly that might make them more understanding, maybe even more welcoming to you to come into the study. But I wondered if you could talk about how you access these sites. And I think you also mentioned having to work out what kind of material you could actually include in your study, since you were doing a study about other research, and what role you took on across, you know, across your carrying out the studies.
Yeah, so that's a big question, and I really puzzled through how to talk about it, because as you can tell, even in just these questions, there's so much material to lay out. And that was one of the biggest challenges in writing the book, is what background context do I foreground and what do I kind of leave out? And that was really, because this book could have been like volumes if I was going to go into detail into all the different things that went into these trials. And I have decided to expand a reflection on my methodological approach in a medical anthropology quarterly paper that should be coming out in the next year or so. But basically in that paper, I outline, and I'm much more transparent and vulnerable about the process of methodologically accessing clinical trials, and specifically the notion of studying up in anthropology. And here in that paper, I'm really reflecting on what it means to study up in a, you know, study up from the margins and in a, you know, white supremacist, heteropatriarchal capitalist cultures. I mean, cultures being context that I was thinking about in these spaces, but those dynamics are still at play. And so the power relationships in gaining access were very different than the power relationships I had been taught in my ethnographic methods courses and feminist ethnographic methods courses, because, you know, of course, in the, you know, when we're thinking about the push, the reflection on methods in the 80s, and I'm thinking about Joan Scott's piece, Can There Be Feminist Ethnography? The idea was that people were studying and researching vulnerable populations, and that these methods and protocols and ethics were developed in light of that kind of a power relationship, and that there would never be a kind of flattening out of those relations of power. And that was, that's very useful. And I teach that to my students today. And then when I think about the intersection of those feminist guides and ethnographic methods and STS, which is the space that I'm finding myself in, which is an ethnography of science, an ethnography of the laboratory, in which these are spaces that are often populated by you know, predominantly white women, white men, and they're in elite academic spaces, because most, if not all, clinical research is designed and funded in the global north. And I use that as a in a critical sense to talk about the materialization of race and empire. So to think that only particular spaces in the globe have the money to design these trials, but that influence the rest of population health, is a power dynamic in itself, in, you know, influenced by colonialism and imperialism. And so I found myself as one of the a graduate student who, a Latinx graduate student who's trying to do research in these areas. And because I had gone through the NPH program and curriculum, I was also seen as just a graduate student. And so the mentoring role started to play a significant kind of dynamic. So that's a power relationship in and of itself. But I think that I was seen as a graduate student trying to learn, and that, yes, I was at the interdisciplinary space of maternal epidemiology and anthropology. And so the scientists were kind of like curious, and also I had skills to share. And so it seemed like a mutually beneficial at that moment. But I also just didn't have that much leverage to negotiate access or data, so permission. So in that sense, I was really at the mercy of the scientists who were willing to be open to my presence. And I was going to basically, I had to agree to whatever kind of access I could get. So that encounter, I was not prepared for. My certain kinds of methodological epistemologies did not prepare me for what it means to be a researcher that it has to study up into powerful situations in which I'm not necessarily holding a lot of leverage. So in that situation, I agreed to being able to study my own experiences as a staff member at the U.S. trial and interview other staff members and review all of the documentation and recordings from that the trial produced. So I had access to a lot of data. I just did not have access to interviewing pregnant participants enrolled in the clinical trials because of IRB purposes. And so that was one of the main constraints. I also decided to anonymize everyone, even though these are public scientists and these are publicly funded trials. And so everyone has access to these public records. I still maintain some, tried to protect any anonymity because I didn't want it to be about individual scientists. It's about systems of power that perpetuate and at some points foreclose the creativity of science and the thinking of new ways of bringing in new science and thinking about them in creative ways. And so I wanted to focus on relations of power, not individuals, in my analysis. And so I was okay with that was important to try to protect anonymity in that sense, even though the scientists didn't ask for me to do that explicitly, but I went ahead and did so anyways. I also am very well aware of the fact that when I was in the field, and this is something else that I write about in the upcoming MAQ paper, is that I had heard, you know, in the grapevine of people who are doing studying up in STS and who are women of color, that you know, scientists are some of the, if you're working with elite scientists. And you ask, okay, I'm going to record you, and do you agree to sharing your identity? And they sign the contract and everything, and that still doesn't protect from the researcher, particularly the anthropologist in this case, from being sued afterwards if the write up does not align with the interviewee's imagination of what was going to come out of that. So I was very careful in thinking about the reality and the risk that anything that I write could not be what people had assumed I would write about. So there was no way for me to control that gap in interpretation and assumptions around what came out of this. But I definitely was very, very careful in explaining multiple times, repeatedly, like, I am an anthropologist and I work on the trial and I'm collecting my own observational data for the purposes of anthropological research and study and publications. And I'm anonymizing, and this is how I'm thinking about using the data in these different kinds of ways. And for my first publication on the trial, which came out in 2018, the preparing that manuscript, I did share it with the PIs. And in one of the labs at the US, they actually read the article as a journal group. And they gave me some feedback. I mean, basically there wasn't that much issue. They were like, you're just interested in very different questions than we are interested in. And you're doing methodologies that are very different from what we're doing. But unfortunately the PI in the UK did not respond. And so I couldn't follow up that much, in terms of incorporating feedback for that paper. But yeah, that the information was shared to them in terms of that write-up. And then I, you know, did my best to kind of, like I said, focus the analysis on systems and structures and not individual scientists, because that was important to the analysis, but also aligned with the feminist politics of doing this kind of research under a very particular kind of position, being oftentimes a young graduate student, you know, a woman of color in these settings studying up. It was a lot more complicated than I had understood, than I could have ever known going into it. But afterwards, I do think, you know, being vulnerable about these politics and processes are really important for methodologically training anthropologists who study up in the future to consider the different dynamics that they might encounter and how to negotiate data access in those settings.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. This is fascinating. And thank you for giving us that trailer, I guess, for your upcoming article in Medical Anthropology Quarterly. So we'll have to watch out for that. And you mentioned having to make these choices with writing the book and how there's so much that you collect and so many conversations and experiences and voices, and you have to make these kinds of choices, you know, and what to put in and what to leave out and how to present it, you know, when you write up the study. And so I wanted to ask you about how you mentioned, I think, in the introduction of the book, that there were some kind of questions or critiques about your writing in graduate school. Yet in the book, you have these very like creative strategies of bringing the reader into the chapter with them. You have these vignettes in the beginning of every chapter. I was going to read just a little bit of one vignette. It's from chapter 3. And the vignette says, "You're sitting in the waiting room of a prenatal clinic. This is your first appointment to confirm your pregnancy. This is a private clinic with art on the walls. The wall sculpture looks like a decapitated woman in the fetal position. You notice how pronounced the rib cage is. You wonder if the art was commissioned as an empowering representation of the ideal woman, thin, headless, with only the essential parts for reproduction. On later visits, you will never really notice this art piece again because it seems to blend in with the whole space, but it's always hanging over you." And so that's just one example of one of your opening vignettes that you have in every chapter. And so I wondered how you came to develop your writing voice, and if you have, I don't know, any advice for, you know, graduate students or other people in the process of writing up their work.
Oh, yes. Thank you so much for the question. And I'm glad that's the first time I've ever had somebody read my book out loud back to me. So it's a very precious first time to hear that land on my ears, because, you know, you're just so, I've written that line over and over and over again 100 times. But to have somebody else read it to me, I was like, oh, wow, that did make the impression that I was hoping it made, but it was completely intangible for me to feel that. I was just hoping that it would land on readers in that kind of way. So thanks for reading that back to me. The development of the writing voice was a long journey, a very long journey that goes back to my relationship with writing and, you know, insecurities and anxieties and imposter syndromes. I really struggle with writing. And so I think that what you read now really came out of an intentional effort to develop a sense of voice. That was one of the best pieces of advice that I got in writing the book, is that you need to develop your voice. You need to be confident in what you're going to say and how you want to say it and who you want to say it to. But it requires a lot of self-knowledge, self-awareness, self-confidence to develop a voice. And it also requires a lot of healing with the kinds of insecurities. And as my good colleague, Emily H. Storr, has said, you have a white supremacist internal voice that's always trying to knock you down when you're trying to write. And that was for me the experience of this like internal voice that would always say, you know, this isn't good enough, like this doesn't make sense, this is really bad writing, and, you know, it's not going to matter to anybody. But to kind of situate those voices into the larger system and disconnect those voices from an internal sense of self was really important for me in my process, along with, you know, obviously a lot of therapy. But in the last few years, I was able to connect with a queer BIPOC writing group, and that fundamentally changed my writing and thinking. It was one of the first times that I really got a chance to just think and write with queer people of color. And in an interdisciplinary setting, I was the only anthropologist in the setting. And so I got to learn from performance arts and English and comp lit and translation studies. And they brought to me this reading of literature and writing of literature that really brought so much light and energy into my voice, because I never really felt comfortable writing in the kind of like Geertz's thick description and ethnographically thick and bring the people to life and, you know, or the poetic kind of narrative, beautiful writing that other folks can manage. And in anthropology that I just didn't have that style. And so I kept thinking, what's another style that felt more comfortable to me? And while I was reading a lot of Claudia Rankine's work and other poetry alongside this very real constraint that I could not write specifically about any individual pregnant person, and that I, in order to anonymize them. And so I had to first cut, one of the two ways to address this was like creating composite ethnographic characters, which I can get into. But the other way was to create a second person vignette that would kind of obviously satisfy the requirement for anonymity, but also it served another purpose, which was to place the reader into this position, create a sense of empathy, and analytically intervene on kind of manifest, materialize the argument, which is that everyone participates in these processes, even though we've created the myth that it's individual, and even though we've created this myth that it is essentially only biologically, quote unquote, assigned females who participate in gestating and birthing. And so I think that the second person vignette really helped me kind of make that intervention real, create anonymity, and write in a style that was a little bit more comfortable to me and diverged a bit from the traditional anthropological description, but was very well developed in literature and in other areas that it was great to kind of see. And, you know, this isn't just there were other people that were also doing this. For instance, in the introduction in Renee Almeling's book and in the introduction of Jill Fisher's book, which is really trying to kind of get people to get into these spaces that are very, very hard to access. And so, but I wanted to do it one further by really making a political statement around who is specifically imagined to take on these positions. And it could have gone both ways. I know my reviewers kind of were split on this, and then but I think that they could kind of see the through line by the consistent returning to this voice in lots of different kinds of ways throughout the piece. But the other purpose for this writing style was to be able to kind of share an essence of the chapter in a way that a lot of quotes at the beginning kind of tend to do. But and I was like, okay, the activity is what would be a scenario that would capture the argument of this chapter in this kind of creative way? So that was my like writing prompt, would to be like, okay, let's use a second person and create the scenario in which I retell the argument in this different kind of way, so that I also know what the main argument is of the chapter. So if you can rehearse the argument in lots of different voices and styles, you're kind of like getting a little bit better handle on what the argument of the chapter is. And so that was also what I was trying to do. But retrospectively, the second person vignettes throughout the book serve practical expectations that were externally imposed on me, internal exploration and creativity around developing my voice, and an analytical purpose for thinking about the interventions that I was making in each chapter and in the overall book.
Yeah, that's great. That's great advice. What you said about situating your inner critic or your internal voice within a larger structure, and to kind of like externalize it, take it outside of you. And then, what you said about the purpose of the opening vignettes was really interesting. I'm working with students right now in the writing their thesis, and I'm we're talking about ways to open up the thesis and open up the different chapters. And I had never seen this done before. And so this is just another tool that I hope to communicate to them, but I know that readers will find to be really engaging in reading your book. And I'm glad that, yeah, you're welcome. I'm glad that me reading that landed also for you as well. So this is the final question that we usually use to close out the discussions of the book. And they are, and so now that Weighing the Future is out in the world, what projects do you have coming up? What projects are you planning for the future?
Thank you. So I'm currently on research leave supported by the AAUW postdoctoral grant, and it is in support of a project that I'm trying to think through called Postgenomic Reproduction and the Aftermath of Failure, which has a few different threads. And obviously in preliminary stages, these kinds of projects are still very ambiguous and nebulous, but I am interested in following up with a lot of the clinical trials that I looked at are inconclusive. In other words, they failed to show any improvement in health outcomes across the two groups or any difference in health outcomes across the two groups. And so I was thinking about, what happens when scientists are confronted with this failure. And this is consistent with a lot of the other studies that are coming out of in epigenetically specific studies that are failing to find traces of epigenetic modifications in human populations, specifically within the context of reproduction. It's really hard for a lot of different reasons. And Amy Nahn and Thayer have a great explanation for some of these challenges in designing epigenetic studies that specifically look complexly around stress and immigration and pregnancy. So I was really curious. I'm like, okay, so what happens if we can't find what we think we're looking for, but actually the findings are also common sense that like racism and stress negatively adversely impact pregnancy. Do we need more data? And a lot of my colleagues and I are yelling out loud that we don't actually need any more data because we have the answers. We know that stress and racism impact health and reproduction and pregnancy and early development. And so it is a political choice to continue to fund research that tries to ask these questions and then are not coming up with answers. And in the worst scenario, it could actually start to influence policy and saying, oh, there must not be a connection here because we're not finding it in the research, in the clinical trials or in the studies. And that's a dangerous outcome of this. And it just reinforces this idea that like these individuals could potentially be targeted for more and more interventions. So that is an area that I'm thinking about and also is very much related to the expansion of ideas around intergenerational trauma and the ways in which we're trying to think about that scientifically, if our methods and tools are having a really hard time corroborating that, but we have obviously experiential knowledge and testimony to think through these things, like what are the limits of our capacity to politically make choices on distribution, redistributing resources, but our methods and tools and prioritization of data and knowledge and evidence, still kind of inhibit a more capacious, creative interpretation and translation of emergent science. So the second project is really taking on these bigger questions, but in lots of different kinds of ways, looking at studies that have failed, looking at the ways in which scientists respond and thinking about, what are the political stakes in continuing to do these kinds of studies reliant on very particular kinds of methods when it's just not really able to capture the complexity of emerging ideas. So that's one of the areas that I'll be working on.
That sounds really great. And I'm really looking forward to hearing about that and hearing about those findings in the future. So I have been speaking to Dr. Natalie Valdez, the author of the book, Weighing the Future, Race, Science, and Pregnancy Trials in the Post-Genomic Era, published by the University of California Press. Thank you so much for writing this book and for sharing it with us here on the podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me.